This is an interview with Mr. William D. Centilli, Sr., a native of Del Rio, Texas. In this interview, he will tell about what he remembers of Del Rio from around 1921 to 1941, delving into the different aspects of life during that period. He left Del Rio around 1943, having been drafted into the Army during World War II. After he left the Army, he moved to San Antonio with his wife. He lived there 15 years. He is presently living in Devine, Texas, a small town about 35 miles southwest of San Antonio. If time allots, he will go into some detail about the changes he saw in that 20-year span, 1921 to 1941. He still tells tales of the changes that this country has made in the last 50 years, from a backward nation to a space age one, and he has lived to see it all.
Okay, done.
Well, talking about school, when beginning in 1921 to 1941, the school there in Del Rio, I was born and raised, was a small school made up of a two-story building with about 14 rooms, and each room was at least two different grades. This was taught by one teacher, and up until the seventh grade, that's the way the classes were held, or 45-minute classes, and then the next class would have 45 minutes, and the one that was citing the class before would have a study period. You had one teacher for 4.5 months. There was no changing around from the first grade on up to the seventh grade. The population in Del Rio was about 9,000. Most of them were Mexican American. All the young children of Mexican American birth, lots of them couldn't speak English, so they were sent to a separate school for about 4 years until they learned the English language and also how to get acquainted with the other children of their own age. At the same time, they would not hold back any child or any American boys and girls because of a language barrier, so that's why they had them separate. For some reason or other, the Mexican people would rather speak the Mexican language at home, and therefore lots of the children never did learn anything about the English words until they did go to school. Another thing, there was hardly any Mexican teachers in the system. They might have been one or two, but most of them were American-speaking teachers. And therefore, it would have been a hardship on not only the teacher, but the student. But there would be no way of language communication. And in same time, we had no food, government food or lunch for the kids at noontime like they have nowadays. You had to either bring your own lunch at noontime or you'd go home at noontime to eat, or the parents would pick up their children if they were small to take them home and bring them back to school. There were no buses. If you got to school, you got to school on your own. And you left on your own. All your parents had made some kind of preparations to bring you to school and to pick you up. In the major activities or athletic functions in school, mostly shinny, or baseball. Well, shinny is, you take about 8 kids and put them in a circle around a hole in the middle of the circle. And the circle might be about 10 feet diameter. And every kid had a small stick, about as big as about the length of a bat, but about thinner. And you have an old can of some kind, and you have one kid on the outside of the circle trying to get that can into the circle, into the hole. And these other kids try to keep the can from getting into the circle and into the hole. And that's a little rough on your game. It's a rough game because sometimes you get your shin hit by another one's stick, or if you're bending down, you're liable to get your head busted.
So that's how the game
got its
name?
And that's how the game, that's how they call it shinny, I guess. I don't know, but it's a very interesting game. You don't see it played anymore, but in that time, that was a good game, or one of the games they played. Another one was baseball, and that was seemed to be a lot more played than most of the other games. Tennis and basketball wasn't too much played then.
Were these activities played in the elementary school, or were they played in the high school?
They were played in the elementary school, these particular games. They also played tug of war and there was another one that you call Rover. Call the person's name out, tell them to come over, and then they were supposed to try to break the run about 15, 20 yards to the next line of people that they were holding hands, and they were supposed to try to break through that line. And then the other side would call the other to come over, send one over to see if they could break their line. And that was a pretty rough game.
Were these organized activities or just during the recess?
No, these were organized just for the recess and the noon hour. We had no physical education whatsoever. It was strictly up to the students to organize their own game and group up to whatever they wanted to play and go ahead and play. There was always a teacher or a ground supervisor on the ground at all times, because of being in so many games that were pretty rough, there was always somebody getting hurt. At least once a week somebody got hurt. They had also played a very little bit of tennis. They had two tennis courts there, but very few people played tennis. Most of the kids would sit around and talk during the noon hour. There were very little games played during the noon hour, except maybe for baseball. Then when you got into high school, then most of the kids had their own car or a horse or something, to where they would take a ride around for a few minutes and come in just before the 1 o'clock bell rang, and then they would a class in high school, you had 45 minute class, and you had to have three elective subjects you had to take, and then you had two that you could choose to take that would give you a credit. Like most of the boys took what they called FRA, Future Ranchers of America, which is a two-hour class. I mean, an hour and a half class, or two classes together. And the girls would take Future Home Makers, which one the fall class was set up for them for cooking. The spring class was set up for sewing, so they could choose that, or you could choose a social study of some kind, or you could choose some kind of a government or physics. But your main three that you had to take was your English, your arithmetic, and history, some kind of a history. Those you had to take.
What about science? Was science stressed back then?
Science and chemistry was you could take it or you could leave it. You could take government and it for a substitute. I mean, it was not a required subject. Then, in high school, you had your classes, and every class was taught by a different teacher. You had a teacher that was taught nothing but maybe two or three different kinds of math. And he taught four or five classes. Usually he taught five classes every day. And he could teach two or three different kinds of math, algebra, or geometry. And they usually were pretty good teachers of that. Then he had one that taught Spanish. She taught the two different grade levels of Spanish. Then you had others taught social studies, one that taught chemistry, another one, maybe two or three of them taught English. But whatever the teacher they hired, they just taught that one thing, either English or math, but they taught all grade levels of it.
Did you notice that when they hired their teachers, were they fit for the subjects that they taught, or did they just place them where they could place them?
No, they selected their teachers from what they said they were specializing in. And in that day and time, they were very strict on hiring a teacher. They had to be from a college graduate, and especially in that particular subject that they were going to teach. There weren't too many teachers in the educational system, and there weren't too many big classes, especially in high school. I imagine the biggest class that I remember ever attending was 21 students. Your vocational agricultural class, I think, was about 18 or 20 at the most. So you had a chance of more class participating in their class because they were able to have the time for everyone to say something about the particular subject of the day in the class. And also the teacher could manage that class a whole lot easier with a small class. and he couldn't. When they had asked questions, usually you would be called on to at least answer one question each student. Where if there were any big classes, I don't think they would have been able to ask the same questions that they were able to. They were also very strict in all grades. And well, obedience was one of the main things that was taught to children. If they did something wrong, they'd get their butts beat. And there was no ifs, ands about it. If Papa or Mama didn't like it, they'd have to come down to the principal's office and express their wishes and desires to the principal or the superintendent of the school, which very few parents ever said anything about it. Most of them, if they went home and told their mothers or fathers they got beat at school for something, their papa or mama would beat them again. So usually the communication of foul play with a student because of his own actions of that day was usually left in the superintendent's office. Nothing more was said about it unless some friend passed it on to mama or papa 2 or 3 days later. Otherwise, it was left there at the superintendent's office. And the kid took his punishment, boy or girl.
Did the teachers do the punishing or did the principal?
No, the teachers went down to the office with the kid, explained the situation to him, and if the kid needed a whipping, either the principal gave him a weapon or a great big 245-pound football coach laid the strap to him. And once in a while, a teacher would take a kid out in the hall and beat him. But it would be because it was for some direct disobedience or something funny that a kid tried to pull on the teacher, and the teacher there wasn't going to take the time to go to the principal with him. They just took him out in the hall and his bottom. But discipline in the classroom was a very strict item, and the teachers would hold it so they were a student or the group of students in that class just knew how far they could go with any one of the teachers. And they knew when to stop when it come to trying to pull something funny. And lots of kids tried once in a while to do something funny. And if they got caught, they got beat. Another thing, graduation in the high school, when you graduated from 8th grade, which was the junior high, into high school, which was a one-night ceremony. And there was no cap and gown. It was just a nice gesture or a nice completing of one part of the education and entering a little bit larger education. Going into high school. Both buildings were separate from each other. When you graduate from high school, you had the whole 2 weeks of your proms and your parties and your banquets and your invitations and all that you have today. And it was a big thing. You also had your cap and your gown. You also had your alma mater, which you all recited together. You also had your class song, which mine in that time was Trees. You never hear this song anymore, but it's there. And one of your biggest athletic games that they played was football. And football in that day and time was a pretty rough game, in the fact that the equipment you used had very little protection set up in the pants or in your pads and things. It was more of a leather padding that they used. Also, your helmet was made out of leather, and usually you sat on it two or three times, or somebody sat on your head with it set on. Why, it come out a very odd looking shaped helmet, and it didn't do much good for, but it did some protection, but not like they have today, everything out of plastic. Also, your shoes, your football shoes, were very heavy. They were laced up above your ankle. You know, had some very tough cleats, rubber cleats, which lots of the boys would get cut up with. And the town would go all out for football. Most of your stores would buy the uniforms for the football players, and they'd have big drives, big boosters, kind of like a booster needs things, in order to supply the team with the best equipment possible. And your football field wasn't much. Mostly it was just a big old open lot, and with a few seats for people to sit down. Most of the people that went to football games had to stand up on the sideline, but there was no seats, and there wasn't very few people to. Very few people would go to the ball games except maybe for the last game or two that happened to be real important. But you had a winning team. Another thing in that time, the transportation to one town to another, if a football team left to go to, say, Eagle Pass or a nearby town 50, 60 miles away, usually the team went, and that was all. Maybe a few people would go, but it would be more than 10 or 12 people because of the road conditions and the working conditions and things like that. The enthusiasm the people had wasn't too high to go out of town to see a football team get beat or win. Mostly the difficulties of travel.
Well, what kind of travel conditions were there back then?
Well, back in 1923 and 24, the year was no pavement whatsoever in the town or on the road. For instance, if you went from Del Rio to Eagle Pass, which is 55 miles away, you would leave, and I remember very vividly the one trip where we went in a Model A Ford, left at 4:30 in the morning for Eagle Pass, and would get to Eagle Pass around 11:30 that day. And that was traveling 55 miles. Whenever you travel that road, you travel with two rifles and about 100 rounds of ammunition. The roads were just plain old dirt roads, very little worn. The grass would even be in the middle of the tire tracks, because it never was graded or to where you could say it was a highway. You crossed just these different pastures. You knew it was a road because they kept putting signs every once in a while, telling you that was the road to Eagle Pass. you crossed, when you crossed the fence, they had no right of way, no fences on both sides of your highway. It was just plain open road. And when you come to a fence, you either crossed it over a cattle guard or mostly a bump gate. And between Del Rio and Eagle Pass, there must have been 20 bump gates. And every time you come to one, it's quite a task to get it open and get through it without getting banged up somewhere or another. The bandits that few people would run into from time to time would try to hold people up on these roads. And that's why most people carry their own rifles for their own protection. Lots of people would travel 3, 4, 5 in a car at one time. And another thing, tires. They were, the rubber was so soft that any kind of thorn or rock or something would blow them out. So you always had to numerous flat tires to have to fix. And you had these inner tubes, and usually you had to, after the third or fourth flat, you usually had to fix your own inner tube. So you had to carry along your own cement, your own rubber patching, and your own air pump, which you had to do all everything by hand. Which that made it a lot of time in order to go from one flat to another. And those kind of trips, whenever you went, you try to go mostly in the daytime, get as much daytime hours in traveling as you could, because you didn't like to be caught out in the country at night by yourself. Another thing, whenever you crossed the creek, it was always on a gravel bottom. When the 1929 and 1930s come in, they start putting concrete on the river bottom, and you cross on concrete slabs. Sometimes you could cross, the water would be maybe 6-8 inches high over the slabs, but if they had any rain somewhere in the vicinity, the thing would be up about a foot or two, and you'd have to sit there and wait till it went down. Usually most of the creeks would run high for a few hours, and then they get back to their normal streams. And then coming in 1930, talking about that same road, they started to pave the towns with asphalt, and they started to put asphalt out on the highways, started surveying the roads and putting out asphalt about anywhere from 5 to 10 miles out of town, and then you run into a state gravel road. And just before you get into Eagle Pass again, about 5 miles before you get into Eagle Pass, you run into asphalt. But the rest of the mileage, about 40 miles, would be done with gravel, but the roads were at least graded and gravel was put in on. And they could go a little faster then. Maybe they were coming out with better cars too, to where you could go 50 miles an hour on the road. And you could go make that same trip to Eagle Pass in 1930 in about 2 hours. Main trouble with a lot of the automobiles again was your tires, and that's just a soft rubber, but you had lots of flats. Another thing, whenever you stopped some of those cars back in 1924 and 25, they had no starters on. You had to crank them, and sometimes you could crank for an hour before you'd ever get the thing started. Lots of them had these little magnetos that they had under them that they used for the electric. sometimes if they got off just a shade, why, you'd be lucky and crank there for a while. Maybe after a little while, you'd get a lucky hit there and the motor would start. So that was a big problem. Then in about 27, 28, 29, they come in with a starter. And you could start the cars with a battery starter, coming with batteries. These cars back in 21 and 2 and 3, and there were very few around Del Rio, but they were had these little magnetos, and they didn't have any your gear shifting like they had with your stick shifts. They didn't come in until about 30. Before, they just had regular pedals. And they had one pedal to back up, one pedal to go forward, one pedal to stop. And it was very difficult to get people to drive. And they didn't have any laws or anything but govern your speeds or your cars or stopping or anything like that, even in your town. Then they start getting police after they find out where cars are running over wagons and horses, pedestrians and stuff, and they start putting in stop signs in your towns, which they didn't have before then.
About when was this?
That was in about 1926 or 1927. Before that, they must have had about 15, 20 cars back there in 1923 and 24 and 25. The rest were nothing but wagons and horses. Del Rio wasn't paved then. It was nothing but caliche dirt and Main Street. Then about 29 and 30, they start bringing in lots of electricity. They start putting in poles for electricity. They also start bringing in natural gas. They watch them tearing up the streets and bringing in a lot of that. Also, water. They would start piping water to the different residents. Before, all they had was just a great big old faucets there close to town or in town there in the stores. And most of the people right in town used their own wells to supply themselves with water. In fact, on my own grandpa's place, he had a dug well. 30 feet deep, which they got most of their water from. What got me mostly on how those people lived in those days and times, drinking water out of those wells, because to me it looked like rats and bugs and everything else drinking water out of them same wells too. Because they were open, there was no way to keep live animals out of those wells.
Was there much a disease rampant at that time?
There was disease in the form of the mostly childhood diseases. The diseases of in the springtime when they had, when one kid would get the measles, like before too long, everybody in the town that didn't have the measles had the measles. Scarlet fever or any childhood disease usually started in the springtime. And they would get passed on right quick from one group of kids to the other. The doctors in the town, I think there was three doctors, most of them were fairly old, and most of them had their education about, what little education they had, it must have been 20 years before that, and a lot of them never went back to school, and a lot of your modern day medicine was mostly government introduced in their communities. I remember when the first shots came out, the government made it mandatory that all kids in the third, fourth, fifth grades had to be shot for typhoid. And there was a lot of trouble trying to get people to get their kids shot, because even the grown people didn't believe in the needles. And to try to get them kids shot and vaccinated for typhoid, for one, and then diphtheria was another one, and then that extract your arm for smallpox, and all school children had to get it, and the government made it mandatory. The state also made it mandatory on the different shots, and lots of parents wouldn't let their kids get shot because they figured that it was infecting their kids. So there was quite a few meetings, community meetings on that, but eventually it all boiled down to one thing: the kid was shot in order to get that preventative from the different diseases. And the doctors also learned from the same thing, because a lot of those doctors didn't know much about the ways of preventing diseases.
What cures did they use back then?
Well, most of the cures they used in that day and time were lots of home remedies and lots of different kinds of patent medicines. I don't anything that came out that had looked to me like it had a fancy label on it and it tasted awful. Why, that was the best medicine the doctor would prescribe. And aspirin was one that they didn't give you a whole lot about. And they had paregoric, for one thing, which seemed to be a good thing for if you had stomach trouble or something. Operations, they didn't do much on operating. If they did, usually it was appendicitis, and I guess about 30% of them they operate on for appendicitis. Most of them was waited too long to get the appendix out, and they usually died. So that was quite a few people dying from those kind of operations. A gallbladder operation was just a 75% chance that you'd die, 25% chance that you'd live if you operate on for a gallbladder. So very few people would operate on for gallbladder. Usually those that were died. And we start getting back in 1930 and on up to about 40, start getting some better doctors were coming in and setting up practice there, and they had more of the newer ways of medicine. Also, back in the late 39 or 40, penicillin was discovered, and that was a great one to cure. And everybody that was sick, you don't care what you had, what they did, you get a shot of penicillin. And usually it worked good. Then it finally found out that penicillin was good for some and it wasn't good for others. And then after the war started, they come out with lots of medicines of your synthetic medicines mostly, which they used a lot. They're using a lot of it today. Also, they come out with lots of new ways of operating, different techniques. They also come out with different instruments, a lot of instruments for operation, to where then back in the 20s, doctors were mostly, I imagine, college graduate doctors that never studied anything more on the new processes of medicine. One thing, communication, that would be passed on from one town to another or to a group of doctors was very poor. There wasn't hardly any kind of communication except by mail. Also, the town grew, it had to depend upon its own self for its feeding and for its maintaining of law, its maintaining of its own community. It couldn't depend on getting a bunch of vegetables, say, from California down to Del Rio inside of 2 or 3 days. That's impossible. You couldn't, if you didn't raise your own food in that particular town, then it was just almost impossible to depend on food coming from any distance into that town. Most of the people had their own chickens, had their own cows, nearly every family in the city or around the outside of the city had their own cow, their own chicken, a few rabbits, and usually they had their own garden, and lots of them wouldn't exchange or sell their stuff, but they would use more of a barter system. Somebody had eggs and they needed some kind of meat or vegetable, or they'd just swap. One neighbor swapped the neighbor for something he needed for something that the other one needed. They did lots of preserving of their foods. They put their foods in jars, lots of the fruit. They also canned their meat, put that in jars. They also smoked a lot of their meats. They also put their grains, make their own meal, cornmeal. They used to make their own sugar. So what they would have to buy a lot would be usually salt, tobacco, coffee.
Where would they
and
get
they
this?
Did that from, they had regular, about 3 general stores there in Del Rio. The train, most of the stuff that ever came into Del Rio that they had to buy would come in by train. So they had the Southern Pacific train there, tracks that went through, and that's what most of the stuff would come in by train. Very little, well, there wasn't nothing coming by truck. In fact, there were trucks weren't even seen on the place around the town. But everything come by train, and if you send out anything, which Del Rio was a great agricultural place for alfalfa, which they made and baled in great quantities, and they shipped out to the army posts at Fort Clark and Fort Sam Houston.
Rail. Was a lot shipped in by rail too?
There was anything needed in that town was shipped in by rail. And if you like lots of wool, which is another great commodity that was raised around Del Rio, was shipped in freight cars by rail to the different wool manufacturers up in Boston that all went by rail. Your mohair also went by rail. Your only travel that could handle any product or anything that was needed in that town had to come in by rail or left by rail. There was no, your highways, like you say, was very dangerous to travel by yourself, as well as the roads were very poor, and it would take a tremendous a lot of time. In your transportation, where you didn't have any, the families and friends and community grew up almost like one in your recreation of the families, the churches, and the families worked a lot together. You would have your different days, like your 4th of July and your Christmas, Thanksgiving, your different Washington's birthday and Lincoln's birthday and your Armistice Day. All those are big days in small town communities because that gives people a chance to get together, and each family would bring certain things of food, and they'd have big picnics, big dances, kinds of games to play, and they would be a competition against different families. Every family had their champion, or every group of families had a certain champion, and they would always match him with the next group of families' champion. And there were all different ways of entertainment that they would provide, and they had to do that, and they couldn't go very far. Most of them couldn't even leave the city limits because they didn't have the transportation to leave, but they did have horses and buggies and things where they could get to a picnic ground. One of the favorite picnic grounds there in Del Rio was San Felipe Springs. They had a beautiful park there that they used, and they still do use for their picnics. Another thing, when they first paved the Highway 90 north of Del Rio out to the forks in the road, at the end of the pavement there, which was about 7 or 8 miles from Del Rio, at the end of the pavement there going to Sonora, they used to use that for a big dance floor. And there was no lights or anything, but usually whenever the moon was at its highest in the month, why then they would plan a big dance, and everybody would go out there to that end of the pavement there. But there was no cars after dark, no cars coming to Sonora, which was too far away. And so they knew they were safe to have a big dance and use that big piece of asphalt to dance on. And that was one of their favorite places for a long time.
What other type of entertainment did you have?
Well, they had these picnics. They had pitching horseshoes, which they had a number of sets of horseshoe places set up. But usually a big part of the town would turn out for these big picnics. They'd also have different fiddling contests and different singing contests. And they'd have these potato sack races, and they'd have regular races, and they'd have horse races, and they'd have something like your old rodeos, your bucking horses, your roping, and they'd have trying to catch a greased pig, and your goat roping contest, and your wild cow milking contest. You'd have some of the girls on sewing, see how many stitches one could put in a piece of cloth in, say, 2 or 3 minutes. And cooking contests. And then they'd have lots of judging contests. They're judging of different kinds of preserves, different kinds of candy, goods that they would. Well, I said canned goods, they were all bottled goods. There were no cans in that day and time. You would Everything was put up in either curd jars or mason jars. And even your beer was put up in bottles. And they had a rubber band around the plug that they put on the top of the beer. Your soda water was the same way. And the top of the beer was made out of glass. And it just snapped down over the opening of the bottle with a rubber washer on it. And that's the way they fixed their beer. They also fixed their soda water that way. And cans didn't really come out and be put on the shelves until, I think around 26 or 27, when the stores started getting canned peaches and stuff like that. It started to be shipped in from California to Florida by rail, and the stores start putting it up on their shelves, and they sold very little of it for when it first started coming out, because most of the housewives did their own canning. So lots of times that canned goods stayed up on the shelf for a long time, and lots of people had the people in them days were very suspicious of most anything new. And when they start putting cans up there on the things, they figured they'll let some kind of acid or something would be in that canned food, and the food wouldn't be any good, so they wouldn't buy anything in cans for a long time. They was also suspicious of anything that come into town, any foreigners or any people that would hit town. Like the gypsies would hit town. Where they come from, people never knew, but they'd hit town maybe once or twice a year. They'd go from house to house seeking people out to tell their fortune. And lots of times they claimed that they would steal the young girls, the boys, when they moved out. Several times there were usually kids missing, I don't know. Think they ever found them, but anyway, they figured the gypsies got them. Another thing, back in the early 20s, the Indians used to come in from Mexico, the whole big tribes, and they'd camp out on that big Caliche Hill north of Del Rio, and they'd wait there for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, because the United States government was supposed to send one of their Indian representatives down there to pay them so much money that they were supposed to pay them every year. And so that whole hill would be just as colorful as could be, because these Indians would move in there and they'd bring on their own costumes and things, and they'd also put on dances for the town to go up there and look at and see, and they'd charge them about a nickel, I mean, a head get in to see these dances. And it was something to look forward to, because it was something different. And that's what the town in that day and time was looking for, something different, excitement or whatnot. And that was some parts of the year would supply that kind of excitement. Then about once a year or twice a year, a big, what they call a Chautauqua. Companies that traveled all over the United States, they'd move into Del Rio for about a week or so and put on a number of stage shows and various entertainments that they would put on their stage. They'd also hire a few local talent around there and fit that in on some of their shows, which was real nice. In a way, because most of those people were artists in putting on a particular play. They were dedicated people, and it was done so nicely, and for being such a bad way of traveling from one city to one town to another, it's wonder how they got all that equipment and people from one place to another. And yet they've done a very good job of entertaining. They also helped a lot of people in that surrounding area that had some kind of talent, and they would try them out, and they could tell them, well, you've got something to keep going with, or you don't have nothing, quit it. And being there was no radios or televisions or in the town to where young people could listen to or listen to something from the outside, most of the kids had to supply their own entertainment. And therefore, the parents and the family was all grew up together with most of the same entertainment or enlightenment of new things to come and new things that were happening. It would be all together, because that's about the time they would get it. It would be all at one time. Communications, they had telephones there, the old crank telephones. Most of the time they didn't work. Maybe you'd spend maybe 2 to 3 hours cranking the thing before you ever got somebody to answer. Or something was down, they always had some kid had a kite and wires and tangled up. We pulled the whole works down, the very crude equipment that they used. That was the best they had, but it was all in the making. So your telephone, another thing, I think they put about 20 people on one telephone. So when it did work, you'd have to wait your time before you could get the telephone. And I remember when the first radio that my aunt bought was, they could get only one station. That was WAI out of San Antonio. And I watched them put the aerial up. They had to put an aerial up about from the top of the house to the top of the barn, and then bring it into the living room and hook it up to the little box that they had. And then they could get WAI in San Antonio, and that's the only thing you could get. And I thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened. I was just a little old boy, about 10 years old, and to hear that voice come out of that box, and if they hooked up the wires, why, that was just unbelievable. It was just, well, if somebody would have told me about it, I wouldn't have believed it, but there it was, right in front of me. And I watched them put it all together, and there they were getting this voice from 165 miles away. And then another thing that got me was when they put a inside toilet in the house. Everything was outside toilet. And the funniest part of it is the house divided. The young people used the toilets inside, the old people used the outhouse. You couldn't get the old people to understand that toilet inside was going to do the job of that one outside a lot better. So there you can see the old people going out to the outhouses instead of using the toilets inside. And that was really something, to have water inside. Most of the water you had to bring from the well. When they put the water inside, and the electricity and the bulbs they used must have been about a 25 amp bulb, because it just light up a room a little bit brighter than a kerosene lamp. And I cleaned up many a kerosene lamp chimney. Now the little kid, that used to be the little kid's job to clean those smokestacks on those kerosene lamps, and to cut the wick, and you had to cut it exactly straight across. But if you cut it at an angle, the old stuff would burn a little bit higher where you didn't cut it, and it would smoke. And you would smoke up your your glass real quick, so it had to be always cut real straight. You always find it, your mother and father, making sure that before they lit that kerosene lamp that it was straight, so you get all the light you could from a kerosene lamp. And those first bulbs were clear bulbs, and they were a little bit brighter than your kerosene lamp, which was enough to where you could see without running over something or anything in the dark. But the lamps were, they just had one socket in each room, that one little light. You had no iron, electric iron, no electric appliances whatsoever when they first came out of electricity. Then they started to bring out the radio, use electricity with it, and the iron. And that's all you had for a long time. Then as the different years progressed, after they put electricity in the house, and they started getting different things that were made from electricity, and they start getting a better electrical power into the home, and you start getting brighter lights, and then your ice box came into being. The electric ice box just started to come in into the homes along about 1936 to 37, where everybody could afford them. Before then, you used ice. You had an ice man. You could come around and deliver your ice every day. 50 pounds of ice, and it cost you 10 cents. And every morning, about the same time, about 10:30 in the morning, he used to hit the house. He used to take, put 50 pounds of ice into the ice box. And that was every day. And then when the ice box started coming out, the Frigidaire started coming out, a lot of people didn't buy them because they were always having so much trouble with them. And who did buy them, why, had to keep them up in repairs. It cost them more at that day and time to keep one going than it would to buy the ice. But as years went by, they kept improving them, and different companies started making them, and they started in competition with each other, so they kept outdoing each other on more perfection in the motor and freezing parts of it. And lots of people began to learn about it, and you could get lots of repairs done with them. But people that were knowing how they worked was coming to town and setting up in business. And your transportation and communications were getting to be a lot better. And therefore your refrigerators began to work real good. Then when the war came there in 40 or 41, then they had to quit making the refrigerators, and you couldn't get any. And there for a long time, it set that particular industry back until the war was over. And then after 3 or 4 years after the war, then they started really making lots of refrigerators, and then they start making freezers and all kinds of appliances. But talking between 1921 and 1941, in that time, there was a lot of invention in many ways, in not only agriculture, but in your communication, and also in your traveling, and your different kinds of motors, also in agriculture, where you come down, most of it in that area and in the area all over the country was done by horse, and all your what few implements you had was mostly a horse-drawn mowing machine. a horse-drawn plows, horse-drawn rake, horse-drawn combine, and even your baling was done by horses. And so there wasn't hardly any kind of motors being used in that day and time for your agriculture. Even to haul your stuff to the railroad tracks, they used wagons that they drawn by 4 and 6 horses of you. All your lumber and stuff that was brought into your town was also brought in by your freight trains. And being in that particular part of the state, anything that you built in your home that was built by lumber that was coming from other parts of the state. And most of the homes in that day and time was built out of adobe, which is Mexican made out of your caliche, dirt, and straw. And they made them I think there were 10 by 4 by 16 inch blocks. And they press them real hard together. And they set them out in the sun, and they bake them and make some kind of a form out of lumber. And then they pack them into this form, and then after they dry, they set them out in the sun and let them bake. And that's what they made lots of buildings there in the town. And a lot of the homes they were made out of that. And sometimes you find some of them, people that could afford a big home would make a two-story home out of, and they're very cool. And being that they didn't have no air conditioners or anything like that in that day and time, a real cool adobe-built home was a luxury, because they were getting up to the 100s, 95 and 100 in the summertime, and therefore a nice cool home was really something for people to live in. Then they made lots of lumber houses, which were hot. They put a lot of windows in them. The more windows you have in the house, the more breeze goes through it, and the cooler it would be. That was the general idea that day and time. And if you notice, you go through some of these old towns and see some of these homes, you'll see lots of windows in the home. In fact, some of the windows went plumb down to the floor, and as close to the ceiling as they could get were the windows. Most of these windows they looked like doors, but they were windows. So they figured the bigger the window, the more windows they could get into the house, the cooler it would be. That was their theory at that day and time. Another thing, they figured that the higher the ceiling in a house would make the house a lot cooler. And they also, to raise it up off the ground about 4 or 5 feet, the higher off the ground you got, the cooler it would be. That's the way a lot of the people that were constructing houses at that time were thinking about, in order to seek out the comforts in a home. And that's the way if you look today in the old homes of 50 years or better, lots of them are built that way, and that's why. Because if I build the comfort into the home, and that's what they figured would help. Also, they put in lots of natural gas into the home. Lots of people when they start putting in electricity, put in natural gas lamps into the rooms. And sometimes in the old house, you'll still see those old lamps hanging on the walls there, where they use natural gas to light up their homes. There are lots of people's homes burned down because of the natural gas. The pipes were inferior. Okay, when they start coming out with the plumbing of pipes, they didn't have these machines or these little delicate things to measure the thicknesses of your pipe or something like they do today. And so they just made the pipes and they had no way of checking them, and they figured, well, they'd be all right, but lots of times the seams would break and the gas would leak and get up into the walls and up over the ceiling, and then it explodes, burned down, and lots of homes were burned because of the material that was used. They weren't guaranteed. Then they come out with the laboratory. After they start seeing that lots of your inventions, lots of your things that were being developed had to be tested, and you got your Good Housekeeping magazine came out. So whenever they would get a hold of a new invention, they would test it out thoroughly before they put a seal on it. Also, your electrical supplies and all that stuff had to be tested and approved by your, what is it, UL approval. And they had to do that to help protect the people that were buying these things, putting in their homes, because otherwise they were dangerous things. Even hot water. There's many a time they didn't get hot water into the homes until it must have been 1932, 1933. Up until that time, if you wanted hot water, you had to get it on your wood stoves and boil your own big pots of water to get your hot water. Also, for your cooking in your kitchen, most of the time they used mesquite wood, and they had special men. Their specialty was cutting firewood for the kitchen stove, cutting firewood for the heaters, and they cut them in chunks, big 12-inch chunks of mesquite for your heating wood. And then for your cooking wood, they split these chunks up into little bitty slivers, like, so that you could put them into these small places in your cook stove. And then about 1925 or 26, they came out with some of your real modern kerosene stoves, and they were awful dangerous. Lots of times, lots of people got burnt by them. And another thing with the kerosene stove, if you didn't wash it, lots of times your food would smell or taste like kerosene. You got that smoke too much. And there was no ventilation in your kitchens to carry off that smoke and stuff. So they were very dangerous. Lots of people being in this gadget and everything, they always tried it out. And then, but most of your cooking was done by wooden stoves. And boy, that was something in the summertime. So those big old stoves were fired up, and they were hot. And our kitchen was one of those in it during the summertime. I don't know how some of the women stay in that kitchen all day long and cook because of the heat. And and that's what they did. They started cooking from the time they got up in the morning until 5, 6 o'clock maybe. They made their own bread, they made all their own food that was on the table. They weren't preserving, they was cooking. They made their own biscuits. And they always had the fire going in those big old stoves. In the wintertime it was all right because you use that heat. The place warm. You didn't have to worry about any heat in the wintertime in the kitchen. In fact, lots of people in December and January used to move into a room next to the kitchen with beds. And some of them had such big kitchens that a lot of them even had a double bed in the kitchen. Because the rooms were a little bigger than this room here. Most of the kitchens were.
About how big were they?
Well, this one, most of them, the houses that we lived in, the kitchens were, must have been 16 by 20. And some, I know one that was 16 by 25. Because it had a big stove in it. It had a big utility table on one side of the stove. It had a big sink and a great big old hot water tank right between the kitchen sink and the stove. Then it had a big dining table right in the middle, and then over at one end it had a big double bed. One of the big old tiny double beds. That was a pretty good sized kitchen. And then in the wintertime they'd move a cot in that kitchen. So lots of times when some of the people would come in and they were tired, they'd just lay there on the couch. I'm talking about the wintertime. The summertime one. Everybody, most of the people wouldn't even sleep in the bedrooms in the summertime. They used to take their beds out underneath a pecan tree or a mulberry tree or some big shade tree, and that's where they'd sleep at night, underneath the shade tree. When it was good and hot. And yet every house when they were built, always was built with a big screen porch. So that's where they, in the summertime, that's where they would move out on the screen porch. And try to keep cool from the hot nights.
Well, you mentioned that some of the houses, or a lot of the houses, put natural gas in kerosene. Where was the main distributor of these?
Well, on your natural gas, it come all the way from Corpus Christi. They piped it all the way in there. And your kerosene, that finally, as more cars came to the town, then they started to put in service stations. But before then, at your general store, they usually had two pumps. One pump was for a regular gasoline, which was a very cheap type of gasoline, and the other pump was a kerosene pump. And the gasoline wasn't even a colored gasoline. It was plain old white gasoline. It was just, I imagine, a bit better than kerosene. But it was a white gasoline. And your little old gasoline motors weren't very much bigger to where that's about, they could use that little old cheap kind of a gas. And it was a white gas, and it was just, well, I don't know, it just wasn't doctored up. It was just the first time they would start refining it. They didn't know too much about it, so that's the best that they could put on the market. But after they start getting the Model A cars in, and your 1924, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29 motors were a little bit bigger, and your cars were a little bit bigger. They start getting in two different kinds of gasoline. He said you could buy your white gasoline for your smaller motor, and then your colored gasoline, which was almost like our regular gasoline today, for your bigger motor. And then they got into making filling stations where you'd have three pumps. One was your white gas, one was your red gas, and the other one was kerosene. The first big filling station that they made was at Texaco Station up close to the railroad track. Because every time, they figured that every time a train came in, people that went up there in their cars to meet people, then they could go up there and get gas at the same time. Or if they were going to take something up there to put on the freight or the box cars, why they was right close by to where they could deliver their stuff to the freight ramps, and then they'd go right by that filling station and fill up the gas to the motor out. That was the first filling station they had there in Dale River, Texaco Station. And it was right there, right close to the railroad station house. And then as more cars began to come, they started to take down the hitching rails there in front of the general store, which was Roach McClymont. Next to it was the bakery. And then in back of Roach McClymont, they had a big lot there where they parked all the wagons and the buggies. Everything, and they had a couple of big watering troughs. They were so big there that us kids and the folks was inside in the summertime buying some groceries. We was in a trough playing around. They were so big. We was getting the trough and had water fights and everything while they were inside. They'd come out, we'd be all wet. They'd wonder why we were all wet. Well, we'd been in those harsh troughs. One of them waiting for them, buying for groceries or whatever they wanted to. Most of the women did their own sewing. So when they first started bringing dresses into the different stores, it took them a long time before people would buy any dresses. Mostly because most of the women made their husband's shirts and their own clothes, and their husband's clothes. And they did lots of sewing in that day, family. They also made their own blankets and their own sheets. So when the store started bringing those kind of things into their places of business to sell, they were taking the chance of just letting it sit there and rot. Because most people did their own sewing and their own dresses, and they were good at it. In fact, they would compete, like I say, on the different holidays with certain things that the women would do in their own homes, and they'd do good, and they'd compete with other homes. Also, shoes in that day and time, they would come from Missouri, and they were button-top shoes. And they had a little hook that you had to use that you put in the hole, hook that button, and pull it through. And that's what kind of shoes they used to wear. And they had no slippers. And they always had, let's see, for the women, I think they had 11 buttons. And for the men, they had 6. And you couldn't get them cotton-picking things in those holes unless you used the hook. And if you ever lost the hook, you wouldn't put those shoes up. Then a little later on, they come with the shoestring shoes. And that was something new. When us kids start putting those kind of shoes on, we figured, boy, that's the height of luxury. Now button our shoes and we don't need that hook. So we could use shoe strings to button to tie your shoes up with. And then, it wasn't until after the war in 1943 or 44 and 45 when they start coming out with shoes that you didn't need no shoe strings of well, the button type shoes went out when the shoe strings started coming. But after the war, then they start coming out with all kinds of shoes that you didn't even need a shoe string with anymore. That you could use a buckle and different things like that with. But what would get me the most was those button shoes I used to have to put them on. And stockings. Women used to make their own stockings. They used to do lots of crocheting and lots of all beautiful embroidery and things like that. Some of the stuff that the women would embroidery they would take down to the picnics or to their bazaars or to their fairs. And the different women would show what they had made were beautiful things. And after about 35 there on, then a lot of these stores started bringing in stuff already stamped. And the women got to buying clothes, and they started where they weren't making them anymore. And then a lot of your synthetics start coming out. Lots of your nylon, lots of your plastics, and lots of your synthetic materials start coming out, or just started to come out in 1940-41. And then when the war started there in 41, a lot of that stuff quit. But up till about 39-40, a lot of that synthetic stuff was starting to hit the market. A lot of your tubing and lots of your different metals were being used for lots of things. Lots of your glass was being shaped into different things for people to use. Your lots of things that ornamental stuff was used with metal. And you could afford them because they were cheap. And lots of it was just for people who like to collect different things and put in their homes. The different synthetics brought to the stores a lot of trade because they people saw that it was easy to get and it was something that they could use, and they start depending on the stores for a lot of their shortages. They like in repairs on stuff that they had got. A lot of people had already bought a lot of this merchandise and put it in their homes, and so therefore the synthetic people could make these parts that would fit the machinery and implements and things. So they would flood these stores with it. So a lot of the people, like they do today, have to depend on the stores of faraway places to support them. Well, back in the early 20s, people didn't have to depend on no one but themselves, or maybe on a neighbor or two. And that way of life was slow, and lots of ignorance stayed ignorant in that day and time, because there was no way of teaching people any better, any large groups anyway. And therefore, they had